Have you ever been really excited about something? Amanda Robinson and I were talking this morning about looking forward to the Tooth Fairy. I told her the Tooth Fairy has more money now than he did when I was a kid, but that's okay. I guess a lot of things have gone up since then. You may see a picture on the screen of the girls as they're at Disneyland several years ago. I think this was from 2003. And Hannah and I were talking about this. We have an agreement that Dad doesn't mention them or use pictures of them until he's gotten prior permission. So I begged for permission tonight, and we talked about how excited we were about making this trip together. Katie wanted to see, I believe, Cinderella was her favorite, and I believe Sleeping Beauty was Hannah's favorite. In fact, I think that's who's on her shirt in this picture. And so they were so excited. Have you ever thought about when you take a trip, when you're going to go somewhere, maybe you can't sleep the night before because you're so excited about the upcoming trip? You're thinking about all the things you're going to do and the people you want to meet or see. Just have you just ever been so excited about something you just didn't know what to do with yourself? What is it that you've been the most excited about, that you've looked forward to? Maybe it was your first child. Maybe it was getting married. Whatever it might have been that you really look forward to. I think we might multiply that and have a sense of what the children of Israel felt as we look at the book of Joshua. Tonight I'd like to talk for a few moments about crossing the Jordan. As we're talking about crossing the Jordan, we're really talking about the story of the river and the rocks. As we focus on Joshua chapters 3, 4, and 5. And I want to just hit some highlights of this chapter and focus on some incredible things God is doing in the life of Israel. And realize that what is happening here is the realization of the most anticipated event in their lives. I want you to think about the fact that many folks say Caleb and Joshua are some 80 years old at this time. They spent almost 40 years wandering in the wilderness. Most of the folks with them are much younger than them because the folks of the generation of Caleb and Joshua died in the wilderness. But even these young people who are about to go into the land with them, they've heard about the promised land their whole lives. They've heard about the mistakes of their parents that prevented them from going. They know that it's because of their parents' failure to trust that they spent all those years in the wilderness. So all their lives they've heard, we could have had the promised land, but we didn't get to go in because our parents didn't trust. But God is going to keep His promise. And someday, we're going in. And we get to Joshua chapter 3. Someday is today. And as we look at this map, I want us to notice we're focusing on the children of Israel who at this time are on the eastern side of the Jordan River. They're just above the Dead Sea. They're just across the river from Gilgal and from Jericho. And they're getting ready to cross. And as we focus on the events of these few chapters, I just want us to highlight four objects, four things, if you will. I want us, as we focus on this chapter, to talk about the ark, the river, the stones, and the knife. The ark, the river, the stones, and the knife. First of all, let's talk about the ark. In Joshua chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and he and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim and came to the Jordan, and they lodged there before they crossed. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the midst of the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, 'When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God with a Levitical priest carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before.'" The Ark of the Covenant is first mentioned in Exodus chapter 25. It was a wooden box made of acacia wood layered in gold. It was approximately 3 feet and 9 inches long and roughly 2 feet wide and 2 feet tall. It had a lid that was covered in gold that had two cherubim with their wings pointed toward each other and slightly lifted upward, and God's presence was said to have been between those cherubim on the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. It represented the presence of God. There were rings on the four corners of that ark, and they would run a pole through those rings, and the priests would carry the poles on their shoulders, for they were not to touch the ark, and that's how the ark was carried about. And so he says, as we're getting ready to go into the promised land, the first thing to go into the promised land is going to be the presence of God. And the emphasis here is on the fact that God is with them, and God is the one who is going to make it possible for their dream to be realized, to make it possible for their dream to come true and for them to go into the promised land. He's going to go on and talk about what's going to happen and how that when they touch the river, it's going to dry up. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a few moments. But what I want us to notice here is the emphasis on God, that God is the key to everything that is going to happen, that God is the key to success. And that is what's symbolized by the ark. I want you to notice the distance they were to keep from the ark. Basically, the distance, and again, it's always difficult when you're dealing with cubits to know exactly the measurement. You usually can get in the ballpark. You just need to be careful about stressing too much the exactness of those measurements. But basically, you're looking at about 10 football fields. So if you've been to a football game and you've seen how long a football field is, imagine lining up about 10 of those. From what I understand, that's roughly about how far they were to stay away from the Ark of the Covenant. And the emphasis here is on the holiness and the presence of God. Remember, when the Ark of the Covenant was in the tabernacle, only the high priest could go in to the most holy place. Only the priest could go into the holy place. And so the people were able to get in proximity to the ark, but not close to the ark. And I want you to think about how incredible it would be to actually see the ark and see it moving out ahead of them. And so the idea is God is present, God is with us, God's power is going to give us victory, but God is greater than us. God is almighty. God is holy. And so there is a distance between God and us. And that is what is powerful about the cross. That is what's powerful about that symbolism of when Jesus died, the veil of the temple being torn in two. Jesus dying on the cross closed that 10 football field gap between us and God. Having talked a little bit about the ark, I want to talk now about the Jordan. The Jordan River posed a significant obstacle for Israel. I want you to remember that you're in the ballpark, many estimate, of a couple of million people that have to cross the Jordan River. Basically, look at the Jordan River, at least the section we're concerned with. It actually starts up above the Sea of Galilee, flows through the Sea of Galilee, and then downward, though it has some tributaries up north and some different names. But basically, as you look at the distance from the lower end of the Sea of Galilee down to the upper end of the Dead Sea, as it pours into the Dead Sea, you've got roughly 200 miles of river crammed into a 66-mile space. And so as you may be able to see the picture, which I think is on your left, it may not be, but as one of the pictures anyway, you can see the serpentine movement of the river. In other words, it goes back and forth and snakes across the land as it moves downward. You also need to realize that they're crossing in flood season in March or April around the time of Passover. The events of this chapter begin about 4 days before Passover. And so it would have been at flood stage. I am told that it can be as much as a mile wide during flood stage. Whatever the specifics are of that, I want us to realize that it is no small feat to get a couple of million people across this river. Remember, you've got men, women, and children. You've got weapons of warfare. You've got all their possessions, all their flocks, etc. You've got to somehow get across this river. It is not only treacherous crossing the river itself, but you might also have dangers from enemies. For example, if it's a small place that you're going to cross, the enemies on the other side can attack you at that small place. And some of our folks may recall the recent movie of about the 300 and the Greeks and Persians and that great battle. One of the keys to that battle and the fact the Greeks held out so long was because the Persians had to go through a little bitty narrow space where even though the Greek army was small, it had an advantage because of the situation. All I'm trying to say is there's a lot of danger that is involved here. And so, in spite of that danger, God speaks of what He's going to do. And as we look at this, I want you to notice specifically it said in verse 7. It says, "Now the Lord said to Joshua, 'This day I will begin to exalt you in all the sight of Israel, that they may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you.'" In verse 10, Joshua says, "By this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that He will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, and the Jebusite. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of the earth is crossing over ahead of you into the Jordan." Look down in verse 13. "And it came about when the soles of the feet of the priest who carried the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan will be cut off, and the waters which are flowing down from above will stand up in one heap." I want to recognize, in my opinion, that not only is the parting of the Jordan necessary for the children of Israel to get across, but it substantiates the leadership of Joshua. There are a lot of parallels between the beginning of Joshua and what you find in the beginning of the story of Moses in the book of Exodus. And what God has said to Joshua over and over and to the people is that He is with Joshua. But He's not just with Joshua, but He is with Joshua just like He was with Moses. And He's going to say in our account that we're reading tonight that He parted or dried up the Jordan River just as He had dried up the Red Sea for Moses. God is not only making it possible for them to get into the Promised Land, He is making a statement. He is affirming the leadership position of Joshua. Just as Moses stood and lifted his rod and the Red Sea parted, so it is that Joshua is going to have the sea parted for him by the power of God. Again, God is not just with Israel, but God is with Israel's leader, Joshua. And Joshua is God's spokesman. And so they are to listen to Joshua, respect his leadership, and listen to his guidance. As you look at this map here, you can get a sense of the significance of what happened. You can see the line showing where they crossed over the Jordan River and they camped at Gilgal, which is near Jericho. And then you can see up north of that on the Jordan River, the city of Adam. It is estimated that it's about 20 miles from the place where they crossed over up to Adam. It is then approximately another 30 miles from the place where they crossed over down to the upper end of the Dead Sea. I've heard estimates higher than this, but best I can tell, you end up with about a 30-mile stretch of dry riverbed. Now, that is not insignificant because remember how many people have to cross. If you've got 1.5 to 2 million people and livestock and all those things they've got to get across, you can't have just a little opening as wide as this auditorium. That's just not going to cut it. And so there's significance to the width of this particular opening in the Jordan River to allow the people to pass. So in other words, just as God parted the Red Sea to allow the people to be free from Egypt, so it is that God parts the Jordan River to allow them access to the land of Canaan and enjoyment of the promises of God. I also want us to focus on the stones. If you look in chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, "Now when all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, 'Take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and command them, saying, Take up for yourselves 12 stones from here out of the middle of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet are standing firm, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the lodging place
where you shall lodge for the night." Now, as you read through the story, it seems that there were two piles. Some say there's only one. I tend to believe there were two. But it looks as if there was a pile of stones that was put at Gilgal, their first encampment in the Promised Land, that was taken from the middle of the Jordan River. Then there was also a pile of 12 stones put in the middle of the Jordan River at the place where the priest stepped into the water and crossed over, and the people began the process of crossing over. And he goes on to talk about the significance of this. In verse 6, "Let this be a sign among you," I'm in chapter 4, "so that when your children ask later, saying, 'What do these stones mean to you?' then you shall say to them, 'Because of the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off, so these stones shall become a memorial to the sons of Israel forever.'" The Israelites are just like us. We tend to forget. Think of all the things we do to remind ourselves. We write notes for ourselves. We put notes in our PDAs. We may have an administrative assistant that we say, "Hey, don't let me forget this meeting on this particular day." We may say to our spouses, "Help me to remember this." In our house, we tell Katie if we want to remember something because she's one of the best I know at remembering things. We all have memory devices to help us remember things. Maybe you've called yourself at home and left a message on your answering machine to remind you to do something. Okay, we all have ways to remember because we're people and we forget. The children of Israel were no different. And so a lot of the things God did, like for example the feast days, they were designed to help them remember things. And so He put this pile of stones so that any time somebody saw this pile of stones, they would remember what God did. And so that children down the road would say, "Mom, Dad, what in the world have they got a pile of stones out in the middle of nowhere for?" Just like when we walk through, you know, Washington, D.C., you know, "What is that big tall needle pointing to the sky there for?" And then we can talk to our children about the general and President Washington. That's what it was all about. Because, see, it wasn't just enough for them to stand in awe of God's holiness that day. It wasn't just enough for them to respect Joshua's leadership. It wasn't just enough to cross into the Promised Land. They needed to remember their covenant with God throughout the generations to come. The generation before them had failed to remember God, had failed to remember what God did for them in Egypt, had failed to remember what God did for them in the wilderness, had failed to remember what God did for them on the top of Mount Sinai. And so what God is doing is He's putting in place some memory glue. He's putting in place a memory device, a system to try to encourage the children of Israel to remember that God was not just with them when He crossed the Jordan, but He's always with them, that He'll continue to work with them as He has in days gone by if they'll just trust Him and they'll just walk in His ways. And then you have something, in my opinion, that's fascinating in chapter 5. As we think about the knife. As we focus on the knife, I find it interesting at the beginning of chapter 5, it says, "When the nations on the western side of the river heard that the children of Israel had crossed over and the river had been dried up," the text says that their hearts melted and there was no longer spirit in them any longer. Remember, we had already gotten a hint of this when we talked about the spies going into Jericho and we talked about Rahab and her family and she talked about the people's fear. In other words, I want you to imagine these nations sending out their spies and saying, "Hey, you know, there's a million plus people gathered on the eastern side of the Jordan River." It's the same great nation that had already conquered two great Amorite kings, so they're scary enough on the other side of the Jordan. But maybe many of them said, "Hey, the Jordan will stop them. The Jordan is our help. The Jordan will protect us." Well, then God dries up the Jordan and they all crossed over, and now this imposing army with the great God who does wonders for them, now they're on our side of the river. And it says they absolutely lost hope. Then God says something interesting. But you think about the story. You've got the enemy right where you want them. They're scared to death. They absolutely have no resolve to fight. They are completely defeated on the inside, and once you've defeated a foe on the inside, you've got him beat on the outside. And so right when they are primed for defeat, God rushes in for the kill. No. That is not what God did. In fact, what God did, well, He debilitated His army. He made them incapable to fight for several days. I want you to look at what He did. In verse 2 it says, "At that time the Lord said to Joshua, 'Make for yourself flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time.'" He takes all of these soldiers, which have victory right at their fingertips, and He circumcises them. Sometime go back and read Genesis chapter 34, and the victory won over Shechem and the people of Shechem because of circumcision. The sons of Jacob won a victory because they tricked Shechem and his family into being circumcised, and because they were sore from the circumcision, they couldn't fight, and they completely wiped them out. So here the children of Israel are ready to get victory, and so what does He do? He circumcises His whole army. And so for several days, they are incapable of fighting. I mean, they are vulnerable. If any of these nations choose to attack them, they are physically in no position to be able to fight back. Now, militarily, this makes absolutely no sense. But they weren't going to win the promised land by military craft anyway. Remember, the key to victory is the presence and power of God. If they're not in a relationship with God, it doesn't matter how strong their army is. It doesn't matter how wise their leaders are or how sharp their weaponry. Battle belongs to the Lord and to the people who belong to the Lord. And it is sad to realize that this entire generation had failed to obey God's command of circumcision. Go all the way back to the book of Genesis. It was a sign that they were God's people. And so their parents had been circumcised, but they had not. And so before they could observe the Passover, they had to be circumcised. And so He circumcised the army. He circumcised the men. He gave them time to recover from that. They observed the Passover. Commemorating what? Commemorating the deliverance from Egypt that makes all that is about to happen possible. It was a reminder that God was not with them just now, but He had been with them in the past, and He always would be. I want you to think again what it was like for these children of Israel as they're ready to go into the promised land. And I want you to think about the fact that God is always teaching. He's always preaching. He's always using illustrations. In other words, God was never content with just doing things for Israel. He wanted Israel to learn of His greatness and power as He did those things. He wanted them to learn to trust Him. And so through the ark, He emphasized to them His presence and power, that He was the key to victory. Through the river, He emphasized the position of Joshua's leadership and that they were to honor God's leaders, not because of the leader, but because of the God who is behind the leader. That God was not just present with Israel, but God was present with Israel's leader. The stones reminded them that they were to never forget what God was doing here. That it was to be permanently in their minds and in their hearts, because as long as they remembered what God did here, there was a great likelihood that they would be faithful to God in the days to come. And in the knife, they were reminded that they are God's people. And that is what set them apart. That was the key to success. He reminded them of what He had done for His people in the past, and that if they would be His people in the present and the future, He would give them victory and deliverance just as He had given victory and deliverance to their forefathers and foremothers. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? As you turn there, I'm reminded that some of the folks who went with us to the country of Panama this last week, several of them were from Virginia. And I don't know if I've heard, did they actually get off this afternoon? Have you heard from any of the gang, Ken? They got on the... I think, last I heard, they were supposed to leave at 12:45. They were scheduled to leave at 4:30 yesterday and end up having to spend the night in Newark. I remember, I think, Cindy and Katie, when we did a mission trip to England, got laid over in Newark. I remember coming back from India several years ago and had to be delayed and laid over twice, once in Bombay and once in New York. If you've ever traveled on a trip anywhere and you've been away home from several days and you've been flying on a plane a long time, you are ready to get home. I mean, those seats, they just get hard after a while. And they can bring you all the snacks in the world, but it's just not the same as home cooking, is it, Miss Jewel? And you're ready to get home. And when you have a delay along the way, it just increases the frustration and discouragement. I just want to be home. I just want to be home. The children of Israel had been delayed for 40 years. Not an overnight stay in Newark or Bombay, but 40 years in the desert. And they just wanted to go home. They were able to cross the Jordan River. The text says they were able to eat of the produce of the promised land. And that was a sign they were here. They had arrived. And the manna stopped because now they had a land of their own and crops of their own. So God no longer had to rain it from the sky. I don't know when it is most folks, when they fly back home, feel like they're home. But when those wheels touch ground, there's a sense, hey, we're home. Maybe it's when they turn off the seatbelt sign and you can stand up. Maybe it's when you run out that entryway or you see your family first time. Maybe it's when not until you lay down in your bed. But for Christians, there's going to come a moment someday when we'll say, we are home. And it'll be better than eating the produce of the promised land. It'll be better than running to greet with open arms loved ones at the end of a runway. For we will be with loved ones for eternity and with a God who loves us for eternity. But to do that, we've got to trust Him enough to cross the Jordan rivers He puts in our way. Tonight, do we trust Him enough to walk in His ways, to remember what He's done for us in the past, to trust Him in what He'll do for us in the future? And have we been through the water? The New Testament teaches us that we can be saved through faith in Christ Jesus, John 3:16. But that faith expresses itself through repenting of our sins, Luke 13:3, through a public confession of our faith, Romans 10:9-10, and through burial in the waters of baptism, Acts 2:38, and numerous other references. Ryan understood this morning that before he could enter into the promised land of heaven, he had to go through the water. Not because of any power in the water, but because of power in the blood of Jesus Christ that made salvation possible. As Israel crossed through that river, are there folks here tonight who need to cross through the river of baptism, who need to express their faith in Christ and put Him on as Lord? Are there others of us who've crossed through that river, but once we found ourselves on the other side, we forgot the Lord who saved us, and we're not living for Him like we should? If we need to change, because the God who helped Moses and helped Joshua helps us, please come as we stand and sing.